Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, the least we can do for rape victims is to stop avoiding the subject. Writer Sohaila Abdulali, who survived a gang rape when she was just a teenager, says our discomfort with the idea of sexual violence gets in the way of important conversations about how to help victims and how to raise boys and men who do not commit sexual assault. We'll also talk to her about a fact few survivors understand in the earliest days after experiencing this devastating crime. It is possible to heal enough to once again experience joy. Our conversation starts after a short break. When Sohaila Abdulali was 17, she barely escaped with her life after being gang raped in Mumbai by men who claimed to want to teach her a lesson. The trauma will never leave her, but more than 30 years later, it also doesn't define her. She grew up, had a child, built a career, built a life for herself. That potential for a good life after sexual assault is something she thinks we need to talk about more. And that is just the beginning. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Abdulali doesn't like talking about rape any more than any other person, but she's come to believe our collective avoidance of the topic is dangerous. It deprives victims of the hope that they might eventually be okay themselves, and it keeps us from wrestling with the nuances and complications that must be addressed if we want to raise boys not to engage in this kind of violence. Her new book is called What We Talk About When We Talk About Rape. She joins us from the studios of NPR in New York. Sohaila, welcome to Think.
Hi, thank you.
You say right at the outset that you will contradict yourself repeatedly in this book. Can you talk about the kinds of contradictions that are tied up in the way we think and talk about rape?
Yes, it's actually, that's what makes it such a fascinating subject to me, besides being personal. Because everything you say about it, you can kind of say the opposite too. You can say it's a catastrophe, which it is. It's a terrible thing. But then you can also say it's not a catastrophe in the sense of it doesn't have to define who you are after it's happened. You can say that it's about sex, because sometimes rape begins as sex. But then you also are very true in saying it's not, it isn't actually sex, because sex is consensual. So you can go on like that. And I also just want to add to the piece that you said when you introduced me. You said that silence keeps victims from getting the help they need or knowing what they should know. It also does something else. It keeps rapists raping, because as long as they have impunity and people know that there's no downside, there's no punishment, there's no accountability, you know, rape is something people choose to do. So we don't want to make it too easy for them to choose that.
So you still had a bruise on your head from your attack when you started college. Was there ever a doubt that you would go to school as planned for your freshman year?
No, not even for a second. It was, in fact, that was one of the reasons why we couldn't report to the police, because they threatened to lock me up and keep me in India if I wanted to press charges, which was never going to happen, because they just were going to up the ante until we decided not to press charges. So no, it didn't occur to me to not go to college.
One blessing in your recovery was your family. They never acted like there was anything wrong with you or that you had anything to be ashamed of.
No, I don't think it occurred to anybody to feel like that. And I was also very lucky, because my father was with me at the time. We were in India. My mother and brother were in America. And he just has never subscribed to the way society possibly thinks you should feel. So he just, his whole idea was just to take care of me, which he did beautifully. And he and I were both a bit shocked when we heard any intimations that this was something to be ashamed of.
So you make it clear here that you don't love being known for this crime that was committed against you. You refuse to let your rape define you. Tell us why you realized you needed to write this book.
Oh, well, the most recent reason is because it's kind of been following me my whole life, because I was raped at 17. And then when I was 20, I went back to India from college with a grant to research rape, and was shocked to find that nobody would talk to me. And that a rape like what happened to me, where a more middle-class woman gets raped by lower-class men, was something that people didn't even acknowledge was possible. So in my teenage indignation, I wrote a piece for a women's magazine with my name and photograph. It was kind of a defiant, this happened to me, I'm not ashamed, here's my picture, the heck with you. And, you know, there was no internet. So luckily it came out and it caused a bit of a stir and then it died. And then 3 decades later, in December 2012, when there was a gang rape and murder in India, which I'm sure you remember,
yeah.
It was Jyoti Singh. At that time, there still had never been a single Indian woman anywhere who had come out and said, I've been raped. So somebody dug up my old article and put it online. And everybody kind of chased me for a statement. I ended up writing an op-ed for the New York Times, which went viral. And then I was happy. I felt I had said my piece. And I retired, but from the subject, I thought. But the thing is that every time I'm a writer, I've written novels, I've written other things. Every time I proposed a book to anyone, they would ask for a book on rape. So this is kind of my book. Now nobody can ask me anymore and I can go on to other things.
So in some families, in some cities, in some cultures, rape survivors find themselves keeping a secret on top of all the trauma they've experienced.
Yes, I think in every culture, I think it happens very much in America. One of the things that shocked me after I wrote the New York Times op-ed was that I got about 1,000 emails from people all over the world, many of them from European countries, some from Asian countries, from all over. And many of them were people who had been raped and had never told anyone. So I think it's really universal.
In wanting to extend sympathy and empathy to people who have been sexually assaulted, it seems like sometimes we make the mistake of implying that they will never be okay ever again. And this is something that you want to make sure people understand isn't a guarantee. In fact, you feel like you are okay today.
I'm more than okay. I'm well.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it is a tricky conversation because you don't want to imply that it's no big deal. You don't want to tell someone, get up and start over, it's done.
Yeah.
But you also don't want to say your life is over. It's not as tricky as we make it, because why would rape be different from any other crime? Why would we not treat it like any other trauma? No matter what happens to you that's terrible or tragic or horrifying, it never goes away altogether. You incorporate it into your life the best way you can, and you go on. And maybe you get over it, maybe you don't. I've never really understood why rape should be separate in the hierarchy of terrible traumas.
You also don't understand why there is a hierarchy created by society about which rape is worse than which other rape.
Yes. In fact, I think some of the people who create that hierarchy is us, the people who've been raped, because, and I'm not sure why, I talk about in my book, I have a chapter called Your Rape is Worse Than Mine. And I don't know why, but I think that what happens to us, people I've talked to who've been raped, often whatever hasn't happened to you seems worse.
Yeah.
Like for me, being raped, I sort of had the kind of B-movie rape where it's strangers, they're armed, my life was at risk. And to me, that seemed like a better rape, for lack of a better word, than someone I know doing it, because that would be an even bigger betrayal of trust. I felt like I could kind of put it behind me. It was not part of my life. I was wrong. But so I think it's that if you know you survived what happened to you, it doesn't seem as bad as something that happened to someone else.
When your story came back to light because the op-ed that you had written at age 20 went viral once again, your daughter was 11 years old and you hadn't ever talked to her about what had happened to you.
No, and I'm not sure why. I have a daughter and my brother has 2 boys and they all obviously knew what rape and sexual assault is, because that was always something we talked about. But it just somehow never happened. I mean, you know, it's not that I was thinking about the fact that I was a rape survivor every day of my life. It was just back there in the background. So I think I assumed I would tell her sometime, but it just had never happened. And now suddenly we were getting phone calls, people were talking, there was going to be this thing in the New York Times. And so I went into a whole tailspin thinking, how am I going to tell her? Is this going to really upset her, destroy her, traumatize her? And then my husband, who is really a very smart person, said that all this baggage we carry around is our baggage. It's not her baggage. You're not, to her, you're not a wrecked human being. You're just her mother and you're fine. So just tell her. And so we did. We were just sitting at the breakfast table or something, and I just mentioned it and I said, this has happened. And she said, fine. And we moved along. And that was that.
I imagine as she got older, were there other conversations about that?
There's some, and she knows about the book and and all that. But I think that it's been such a part of the conversation, and there are so many things in her life to think about. She's a teenager. Yeah. This is not the main thing on her mind. So it's hard to say, but I don't think it's such a big deal.
It's
one of the many stories.
Yeah. One of the many stories that just sort of illuminates your past that she's not entirely part of, but has a kind of a sense of.
Yeah, and is not necessarily at the age where she's thinking about it too much.
You remind us, if we ever hear the story from a friend or a loved one that they've been raped, we need to keep it together and not put them in a position of having to comfort us. I feel like that's such an important thing for you to point out.
Yeah, for many things it is. I mean, you know how it is. Also, if someone dies and you tell people and they're so horrified that you have to tell them it's okay.
Right.
So I actually had an interesting encounter with this phenomenon, because many of the people I knew had no idea that it had happened to me. Not that I had kept it a secret, but just it hadn't been discussed. And so when the New York Times op-ed came out, I had all these people that I knew really upset for me. And, you know, I got an email from one friend who said, I'm weeping as I read this. And I felt really nice that they all cared so much, but I didn't need that. You know, it was 30 years past. I was okay. So I had to write comforting emails to people saying it's fine.
Not all rape survivors are women. And I wonder how the assumption that only women get sexually assaulted affects the way men heal from rape.
I think it's a terrible thing to deal with when you're a man, because there's even more shame and there's even less resources. So I've talked to a few men in my life, and for the book I talked to some men, and I talked to some trans men who suffer even more from stigma. So what I can say is, of course it happens to men, and I think it's doubly hard for them. It's getting easier as people are more aware of it, but it is very difficult, and some of our easy analyses don't really work when it comes to male rape, and that can be better or worse.
Can you think of ways that we could make it more socially acceptable for men to say this has happened and expect some comfort? I think a lot of people seem to be made very uncomfortable by the idea of a man being raped to an even greater extent than thinking about a woman being raped.
Well, I think that one of the things is that it's one of those cases where you do have to talk about sex and rape separately, because there's been this terrible assumption. I know long ago when I was a counselor, when I counseled men, especially men who were raped as kids, it was this whole thing of, does this mean I'm gay? So that's just ridiculous. You know, either you're gay or you're not gay. Being raped really seems immaterial to me. So there's a lot of the stigma has to go. But I think as a society, the answer to all this is to just talk about it more, have it be more in the kind of galaxy of things that come up, so that if somebody, for instance, think of me, I'm not a man, but I never met a person who was raped. I'd never heard of it. No one had ever discussed it with me. I had no place to kind of put it. Now that wouldn't happen, because it's a global conversation. So as long as men are included in that global conversation, that'll make it easier.
My guest is writer Sohaila Abdulali. We're talking about her book, What We Talk About When We Talk About Rape. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can find us on Twitter at KERAThink. Bank. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with writer Sohaila Abdulali about her new book, What We Talk About When We Talk About Rape. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Very early in our conversation, Sohaila, you said that, you know, our silence allows rapists to keep raping. So does our sense that rapists are monsters that we could spot from a mile away.
Definitely. Definitely, because then we kind of put them into this other category and keep them outside society so that the way we behave doesn't encourage, you know, we are kind of, in fact, taking away society's responsibility for making rapists. And the other thing is that I think that that theory is a very negative theory, because if something is a monster out there, you have no control over it. You, as a society, it's just out there. Whereas the actual truth is that rapists are men who choose to rape, and they could, in fact, choose not to rape.
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of conversations, I think we act like men have less control over their sexual impulses than women, and I don't know that there's any scientific evidence that that is true.
No, but I really don't think there is, because in my book, at one stage, I asked the question, there's this whole thing of, you know, we shouldn't lead men on because there's a point of no return.
Right. Okay.
It's like the dam breaking. But my question is to all the men out there who are listening is that if you were having sex with someone, really hot sex, and you were really into it, and the door opened and your grandmother walked into the room, would you be able to stop? I think most people could.
I want to talk about consent, because you get into the fact that it should be simple. We wish it were simple, but it's complicated. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sorry.
Consent.
Oh, right.
Yeah. There's the Tea Party, the Tea video that came out a few years ago, for example.
Yes, there's that. I wrote about that in my book. It's actually a very funny video about someone being forcing tea down someone's throat, and it's like it's called consent. It's as simple as a cup of tea, and it talks about how if someone pours the tea and you don't want it, do they pour it down your throat to force you? And it's a nice little video for kids, but I also think it, you know, sex is not like a cup of tea. Just because someone offers it to you, it's not just polite to say yes, because even if you don't feel like it, where you might do that for a cup of tea. When I say consent is complicated, what I mean is that in my college days, we used to often say yes means yes and no means no. And that's true. But sometimes yes doesn't mean yes. Sometimes you're saying yes because you're nervous, or you feel obligated, or you're frightened, or you're trying to get something that you won't get. Sometimes you say no because you're not comfortable with your own desire for sexual pleasure. So it is very complicated. But my theory of consent is that none of this matters as much as when two people or more, or however many people are having sex, are in tune with each other's needs. If you're a person who's grown up, if you're a boy who's grown up buying into the myth that sex is for men's pleasure and kind of hurts girls and they just kind of put up with it, then how are you ever going to figure out if someone is consenting or not? For you, if the woman you're with is just lying there and not expressing anything, you might think that's okay. So I feel like consent, you need to talk, you need to discuss, but the main thing is you need to care. You need to care how the other person feels, and stop if you think they're not feeling good.
The reality is that before most people are themselves sexually active, the model that they receive comes from the media. And I don't mean specifically pornography, but just, you know, sex in movies. Even if nobody takes clothes off, we have a sense of how these interactions play out. And they don't often model anything that looks like the kind of consent that we're talking about in 2018.
No, they don't. What else can I say? They don't. But I think we can try to improve things, and we can try to model more equitable gender relations in general to our kids, because sex is part of all that. It's not completely separate. If we try to model more basic respect and respect for the right to want pleasure, whether you're male or female, I do think that this discussion about pleasure is part of the discussion, which sounds kind of counterintuitive, because rape is the opposite of pleasure. But you have to know what you're not getting. You have to know what it's not to understand it.
All right, let's go to the phones. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We have Ray on the line in San Antonio. Hi, Ray.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead.
I have a question. It's not anything that I've ever talked about, and you prompted me to think about it because at my age, I've been thinking about it more and more. So I was molested by my brother when I was about 10. Never talked about it. It's not anything that you would ever talk about with anyone because nothing good can ever come of that. I have hesitated to even talk to a therapist because you can't change it or improve it. It has affected my whole life in various ways, and just curious if you had any advice, being that this is the first time I've spoken of this.
Thank you for your call, Ray. I'm sorry that happened to you, and I really I applaud your courage in calling and asking Sohaila what she thinks. Thanks for calling.
Sorry. I think you're amazing. I think it's unbelievably brave to keep silent for all these years and then announce it on the radio. And I'm sorry it happened to you. And I also don't agree that talking doesn't help. I think it does help. I wonder how you'll feel later that you did this. You might feel like, what did I do? But you might also feel good that it's out. So I'm sorry it happened to you. And I don't think it's ever too late to talk to a therapist. And I think some good does come out of it. So I hope, if not a therapist, somebody you find to talk to. But I applaud you for calling.
You have some really devastating stories in your book of people who say, for example, they told their families and their families did nothing or turned around and blamed them. Like, well, what did you expect for wearing a short skirt when you went out dancing? That kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. In fact, it was interesting how the book came about, because when I started writing it, I had some vague ideas of what I would say, but nothing concrete. And then I just started talking to people. And the first 4 or 5 people I talked to all had a story. They were from different parts of the world, and each one had a story where someone literally said those words to them. Someone really close, a mother or a lover, said, "What did you expect?" And so I have a chapter called "What Did You Expect?" And it's true. I don't know why people do this, but people do. I think sometimes women do it because we're trying to protect ourselves. Like, I've told people, especially in the beginning, and had them say, "Oh, I would never let that happen to me." Hmm. So where does that leave me? I let it happen to me. So yes, people are very unsupportive. It's not always out of hostility or sexism or being a bad person. Sometimes it's just out of ignorance or discomfort. But I think that that's partly what I'm trying to say in this book, is that if it becomes a topic that's not so shameful and suddenly hitting you on the head when you've never thought about it, maybe we'll all learn to be a little more sensitive when we talk about it. And also, if we, you know, I'm thinking of my own culture in India, where rape is so associated with honor. If we don't put so much baggage on it, rape definitely is tied up with caste and class and race and all these things. There's no question. But if it's just you and somebody you know who've been raped, that's not what you need to be thinking about. You just need to be thinking about this person and how you can help this person.
So after you were raped, I guess years after, you heard about this class that someone was giving in self-defense, and you were really reluctant to take it. Can you talk about why?
Yeah, actually, it was my fellow. I was that right after college, I had a job at the Rape Crisis Center in Boston, and it was somebody else working there. She was a really good friend, and she ran the self-defense course for women. And I, on the one hand, was really attracted to it, and on the other hand, I felt like I couldn't go, because part of me felt like if I go and I try to learn how to defend myself, then part of me is saying that there's something I can do to prevent rape. Therefore, I didn't do it. Therefore, it was my fault. Hmm. So I got myself kind of tangled up in that whole thing. And then eventually I just went, and I loved the course. And I realized that it's fine. We do all want to keep ourselves safe in every way we can, and do anything. We should do anything we can to increase our confidence and realize that if something happens, it's not our doing.
What did it take for you to feel safe again most of the time?
I think a lot of it was time. And I also, it's hard to say because I don't know how to judge myself against other women who haven't been raped.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know a single woman who feels safe all the time, anywhere in the world, whether something has happened to her or not. So it's hard for me to kind of tease out how much of my feeling of not being safe is because of what happened to me. It's hard to tell. But I think it took time. It took a lot of support. It took my job at the Rape Crisis Center was really helpful because even though I didn't go get therapy, just being a therapist helped me work it out through other people. So it was time and support.
Your book made me think a lot about the double standard we apply to the kinds of risks that are acceptable out in the world for women and men. So I have four teenage children, two are boys, two are girls. I've given the girls each a can of pepper spray, and it never occurred to me to buy a can of pepper spray for the boys. And just reading this book makes me think that's a weird double standard. I'm raising my daughters to be aware that they could be raped at any moment.
Yeah, it is a weird double standard, and it's tough because you want to keep your girls and boys safe statistically. Yeah. As far as rape goes, sure, your girl, you know, it's more likely to happen if you're a girl, but anyone can get mugged. So, you know, I hesitate to say arm your children, but a little pepper spray doesn't hurt, especially in Texas.
All right, let's go to the phones now. The number is 1-800-933-5372. Marie is calling from Arlington. Hi, Marie.
Hi. Thanks for having me, and
sure.
Thank you for talking about this.
Sure.
I have a question about law and consent. Marie is not my real name, and I say that just because I'm in the middle of I was sexually assaulted when I was 16 years old in Texas. The man who did it was in his 20s, and it's currently in the criminal justice system now. It's about to go to a grand jury trial, and the assistant district attorney says I have a 50-50 shot of him being indicted because 16 is so close to 17, which is the age of consent in Texas. And so, like, I just was wondering, I guess, what your thoughts were with that, because, you know, if I had been a day older at one point in that, or my friend who had the same thing happen to her, but she was 17, she can have her case prosecuted because she was 17.
Wow.
But we're still children, and like the law is so black and white in that. It shocks me that the grand jury wouldn't find him and indict him, but people think 16 is close to 17, so surely she was able to consent. I just was wondering if you could talk a little bit about law and consent with the age of consent.
Thanks for calling, Marie. I hope that your case, I hope that you find some justice. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So, Hila, do you have any thoughts for Marie?
I think that I do wish you well. It's really tough with law because the law does have to be black and white, at least on paper, in order to function. And if you're going to have an age cutoff, which I'm not sure I believe in the first place, if you're going to have an age cutoff, you have to have an age cutoff. But I think that no matter what the law is, what you're probably dealing with is people's feelings and emotions around rape. Because, you know, are you a child? Aren't you a child? Could you consent? Couldn't you consent? Would they have the same standards if the positions were reversed and you were a guy and the perpetrator was a woman? So I think you're right. It is arbitrary, but you have to have some black and white things. But people's attitudes towards who's able to have sex is really what matters. And it's what the jury thinks that matters. So I know this is a garbled answer, but I don't actually know the law in Texas. But if they have to follow the letter of the law, they should. If you're one day close to being the age, but you're not the age, you should count as a child. There's no question. I think very often the law is used in a garbled kind of way to under the guise of protecting victims, and it doesn't. In my case, the law said that if you're a minor, which I was like you, I was just 17, little over the edge. And according to the law, as a rape victim, I should be kept under protective custody. And so they used that as a threat to lock me up, knowing that I wouldn't want to be locked up. I'd want to go home and go to college. So I don't know what to say. It's very tough. You can't have vague laws, but at least you should have laws that people respect and keep their own value judgments out of.
Have you made your peace, I don't want to put words in your mouth or use the wrong phrase, with the fact that your attackers were never caught and prosecuted?
Well, I've made my peace 90% of the time. Mm-hmm. 10% of the time, no. It would have been nice, but I also, there was a big part of me that didn't want them prosecuted, because I, even at that age, I had this idea that justice should be actual justice. I wanted them to be punished. I thought they were wrong and criminal and they deserved to have consequences. But I didn't know how terrible it would be for me. That part never occurred to me, and I learned that later. But I do know how unequal people get treated in India. I knew that them being lower class men, I could walk out that night of my house, point to any four men who lived in the nearby slum, and guarantee that they'd get beaten up by the police. So I had this whole thing of, like, I want justice, but they won't get justice. So I was unclear that night. I also kind of wanted to put it behind me. But yeah, it's too bad. I think the thing I felt worse about was not that I didn't get justice, but I felt guilty for a very long time that I didn't do anything, because I was convinced they would do it to someone else. And maybe they did, and that would be on me. And that's a hard thing to live with.
My guest is writer Sohaila Abdullahi. We're talking about her book, What We Talk About When We Talk About Rape. We'll talk more with you after we take this break. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, we have phone lines open. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can find us on Twitter. We are @KERAThink. Listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with writer Sohaila Abdullahi, who is author of a new book called What We Talk About When We Talk About Rape. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or find us on Twitter @KERAThink. Sohaila, before the break, you were saying for a while you felt bad about not the fact that your rapists were not caught because maybe they were able to do that to someone else. I do want to reiterate the point that you came to understand, which is that the only obligation of a rape survivor is to survive. Anything else is really up to them. And if it works for them to report or get counseling or talk to someone, they can do those things. But they have no obligation to do anything other than get through it.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that. And knowing that, I still felt like that at that age. But I also feel like now when I look back on it, maybe it was a way of giving myself a little more power than I actually had. Hmm. You know, thinking that I could have done something. It was kind of a pipe dream. I was naively imagining that I'd take them to court and they'd get put in prison. But if you look around the world, that's really not what happens.
I would imagine that after your story became public the second time around, you heard from other people that you're pretty close to that told you their own stories that you hadn't known before.
Yes, quite a lot. And some of them I knew. It also made me realize yet again how rape is not something that's out there. Because really, if all of us who were raped had been destroyed by it, we'd have a very thin population of functional people. Hmm. So it is more common than you think. And some of the more interesting conversations have been with men who it makes them question their behavior and assumptions. And I think that's a really useful conversation to have.
Yeah, one thing that it seemed like we didn't hear a whole lot of when the Me Too movement first arrived on the scene was a lot of men in particular looking at their own behavior and noting that they might have had a role in making someone, if not sexually assaulting someone, in making someone uncomfortable with their behavior.
I know, I couldn't believe it. Some of the nonsense I was reading, instead of men taking this as an opportunity to reflect and support and question, you saw all these articles about men, oh, now we are so scared to flirt. Now we are so scared to do this. So what if it gets taken wrong? And actually, my 17-year-old nephew had the smartest thing to say about it. When I asked him, I said, what do you think of all these people who are nervous about how to behave now? And he said, if they're nervous about how to behave, they probably should be. Because no one I know is nervous about how to behave.
Yeah. All right, let's go back to the phones. This time we have Mindy on the line in Dallas. Hi, Mindy.
Hi. I was hoping that you could speak a little bit about the best way to navigate a conversation when you're trying to be an advocate for somebody who has been assaulted or raped and people are saying that they were asking for it, whether it's somebody that you know or, you know, some high-profile situation, but that notion that they were asking for it. How do you advocate for that person and navigate that kind of conversation?
Thanks for calling.
To me, it's very easy because if you ask for it, it's not rape. But I think that there's two different things. If you're talking to someone to whom it's happened, the best thing you can do is support them and listen to them. And if they say, I deserved it, I was asking for it, you know, what did I expect kind of thing, if that comes from them, the best thing you can do is support them in their pain, but say, no one asked for it. It doesn't matter what you did. One person, the rapist, is the person who did the raping, not you. It doesn't matter. And in society, and we all have this. While I was writing this book, I had this conversation umpteen times where people talked about, especially once the Me Too movement came to light, well, so-and-so asked for it. Why did this film star say she was assaulted by Harvey Weinstein and then go arm in arm with him to the Oscars or whatever? And you just say that people deal with trauma in so many different ways. Sometimes you're trying to deny it. Sometimes you're trying to get over it. It's just really tough to legislate how somebody acts. And nobody ever, ever asks for it.
Our American audience is, of course, familiar with the Me Too movement. You remind us that American women are not the only ones around the world that are organizing around issues of gender-based violence.
No. In fact, often American women are a little late to the table. At this moment in India, Me Too is exploding. And even before Me Too in America, there were other very similar movements. There was in Mexico, there was the, I think it's called Primavera Violeta movement, where, again, there was a call on Twitter for women to identify themselves who'd been harassed, and it led to mass protests on the street. So people do organize, and it's not, social media isn't the only way they do it. Often, when I was growing up, there was a feminist group in India. In fact, I met them when I went back to do my thesis research. And there were many ways they organized. For instance, in India, it was very hard in those days, and is now too, to leave an abusive husband and family. And so these women would band together and go, they would arm themselves with chili powder and go to people's houses, get them out, and use their chili powder as a weapon. Now that's organizing. It just wasn't written about anywhere.
Can you tell us about the Gate Ladies in South Sudan?
Oh, yes. So I have a friend, well, she became a friend after I interviewed her for this book, Mitali Iyengar, and she works for MSF, Medecins Sans Frontières, and she goes to different countries. So I met her just after she had spent 6 months in South Sudan at a refugee camp. And she led a group of community leaders who looked after the health of people in the camp. And one of the things they dealt with a lot was sexual abuse of all kinds. But like most places, it's a shameful thing to talk about. So what she did was she had a few women who used to be midwives, traditional birth attendants in their villages before they came to the refugee camp. So they're very in tune with communicating with women and women's needs. These ladies were called the gate ladies, and they would stand, they would take shifts standing near the gates of the camp. They would talk to the women when they went out in the morning to collect fuel and water and whatever they went out of the camp for, and then just take a they keep an eye on them when they came back. And if anyone seemed upset or different in any way, they would kind of gently take them aside and talk to them. And this way they would find out if someone had been abused. And they were, she said, they were just amazing. They were full of humor and goodwill and support. And a lot of the cases they had in the camp of people seeking help for sexual assault came through the gate ladies. So they were heroes. She showed me some pictures and I immediately felt comforted.
Hmm. We have an email here from a listener who writes, "My sister mentioned to me a couple of years ago she was molested by someone. It was never brought up again. What steps can I take to ask her more about this situation?"
You can just ask her. I don't think it's ever good to push anyone, but you should never assume because someone doesn't bring it up, they don't want to. It's hard. Speaking for myself as a survivor, I'm always trying to protect other people from the horror of it.
Yeah.
So if your sister told you a couple years ago, it would be so easy to either call or email or meet and just say, you know, given what's happening in the world today, I was thinking about what you said and I'm just wondering, do you want to tell me about it? Or I'm so sorry that happened to you. Just to tell them it's okay. Just to let her know it's okay to bring it up, because clearly she trusts you if she brought it up. Probably took her a lot of guts to bring it up, and maybe she needs a little nudging if she wants to do it again.
A lot of people these days are trying to be sensitive to topics and words and things that might trigger someone's trauma. And I wonder, as someone who experienced and lived through trauma, how you feel about that.
Should I give my true answer or the correct answer?
I want your true answer.
I'll give my true. I have to say that word triggering really gets on my nerves. I understand that you want to be sensitive to people, and you do. But just when we started talking about it, let's not now start saying, be careful what you say, because we've never been careful before. We've said all the terrible things that make everybody feel bad about themselves. Like, what did you expect? What were you wearing? What's this? So now, no, I think that if you're actually trying to have an honest conversation, probably someone who's lived through the trauma of being assaulted is not going to fall over dead because someone brings up the topic. This is my feeling, my true feeling.
My guest is writer Sohaila Abdullahi. We're talking about her book, What We Talk About When We Talk About Rape. If you'd like to join us, the number is 1-800-933-5372. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So I have to tell you, I love your conversation with an educator who said that we need to move beyond sex education that is either abstinence only or disaster prevention. What is disaster prevention sex education?
Well, disaster prevention sex education is what a lot of us get, right? Where you're told, oh my God, if you actually do this thing, wear 15 condoms, you know, make sure you don't get pregnant, make sure you don't get STDs, make sure all these terrible things don't happen. If you're going to have sex, just be careful, please, because so many horrible things can happen. That's the disaster prevention. There's no joy or pleasure or agency or anything like that.
So it really defines sex in very stark terms for young people who might not have experienced it for themselves yet.
It does, and it's sad because it's fun being young and sexual. And it would be nice to get the message that that's okay. And I hope we're doing it more.
I don't remember this coming up in the book, and if it's not a question you choose to answer, I'll understand completely. But what decisions did you make about talking to partners in your life about your experience? Did everyone that you thought you might be intimate with, did you feel like they needed to know about you that you had been attacked in this way?
Well, it's very interesting, actually. No, it's not addressed in the book, but I did, and I can't now remember if everyone was told before or after or during, but not just with intimate partners, but with relationships that were many, many years. It doesn't happen now because it's so long ago and it no longer feels like the major event of my life. But there was this very clear, I'm sure many, many survivors have this, where there's this very clear point. You know with every single person whether they know or they don't know. And then you choose when to tell them, and then you watch really closely to see the reaction. And depending on that reaction, the relationship has a future or not. It's this thing that you use to judge people, maybe unfairly, But it was like this because it was such a big loaded deal. So, yeah, I did use it kind of as a test. And maybe that was unfair, but I did. If I felt like someone had the wrong reaction or a blaming reaction, that was it. They'd lost their chance.
Or told you you needed to be over it by now.
Yes, I had that. I got that a few times.
All right, let's quickly, we have time for one more call. We have Karina on the line in Austin. Hi, Karina.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
I have a friend who was molested as a child, and he just has never been able to find any form of peace. He's had help from family, and I've tried to help him, but he's just been, like, just is very denying of everything. And I just want him to be able to find some form of peace.
Any ideas for Karina, Sohaila?
I think that there's nobody else can tell someone what they need to do. But if you're there for this person and you let him, I think it was a him, mm-hmm. if you let him know that you're there and that you can help him find resources if he wants, or that it's okay to talk, it's okay not to talk, I think all you can do is let this person know that you're there and you're willing to help.
Yeah, I think a lot of people want to be fully empathetic to survivors' traumas and also sort of help them understand that they're not necessarily doomed to misery for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, and I also, one of the fears I had in writing this book was that it didn't want to come out as sounding like, you know, it's not such a big deal.
Sure.
Because it is a big deal, and everyone doesn't come through it. Just like there are many people who are destroyed by many traumas, and that happens too, and that's really sad. But I think that you can look around and you see so many people who have found creative ways to survive and be happy and be content and raise children well, that we need to acknowledge that it's not the monster out there committed by the monsters out there. It's this terrible thing that's with us. And we have some control over how we deal with it, how we think about it, how we talk about it.
Writer Sohaila Abdulali's new book is called What We Talk About When We Talk About Rape. Sohaila, thank you so much for making time to speak with us.
Thank you.
You can follow us on Twitter at KERA Think and use any podcast app to become a subscriber to the KERA Think podcast. If you'd like to check out what we have planned for shows coming up or listen to the podcast straight from the website, you can go to think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.